In my last lecture, I made two observations on the mentality of modern man. I said, first, that the scientific rationalism, which had shattered dogmatic authority, has proceeded further to call in question the reality of vast areas of our experience, including that of our existence as morally responsible, conscious human beings. I said, secondly, that the destruction of the dogmatic authority sustaining a static society has released a demand for an unlimited improvement of society, and that in consequence, social ideals exercise today an unprecedented power over the minds of men. Now, neither of these two observations is new. I could quote a number of book titles in support of either of them. What is new is my analysis of our modern mentality as a combination of these two aspects, as a blend of skepticism and idealism. What is new is my picture of modern man full of moral passions, the expressions of which his skepticism has discredited. I have shown how this combination accounts for the seduction of nihilism and totalitarianism, and, had I had more time, I would have shown also how it tends severely to weaken our own self-confidence for fighting nihilism and totalitarianism. Today, and in the rest of this series of lectures, I shall point the way towards the solution of our modern dilemma by an attempt to vindicate the essential human realities which scientific rationalism has called in question. I admit that I am undertaking this philosophic task for the sake of purposes that extend beyond it, but I believe this to be justified. For any demonstration that man is a morally responsible agent is itself a moral teaching. We may seek, therefore, this demonstration equally on intellectual or moral grounds. I have said that there is a considerable literature deploring the destruction of reality by scientific rationalism, and I should add by its emotionalist twin brother, Romanticism. These testimonies lend support to my enterprise, but they may also appear alarming. The fact that they have remained fruitless may be taken to show that the intellectual position which they denounce is irremediable. It certainly shows that the remedy to this complaint cannot be had for the asking. It suggests that the remedy can be found only by uprooting some basic conceptions which irresistibly impose themselves on the modern mind ever since the rise of scientific rationalism about 300 years ago. This does not mean that I will have to introduce here highly technical evidence accessible only to people with special training. No, what I want to do tonight is simply to call your attention to the great and indispensable powers of unspoken thought to which scientific rationalism has hitherto denied due recognition. This should prepare the way for the vindication of reality next week. The difficulty of this subject is, in fact, not that it is recondite, but that it is too obvious. In the story of the purloined letter by Edgar Allan Poe, he tells how an important document was hidden away by putting it in a place where everyone could see it, and hence nobody would look for it. The power of unspoken thought of which I want to deal tonight is rather like that. It is so obvious as to go unnoticed. And even if eventually acknowledged as a fact, it is extremely difficult to convince anyone that this is a matter of vital significance. For it seems unbelievable that such far-reaching consequences of an easily accessible experience should have been universally overlooked. And yet, this is precisely what I want to show. Perhaps I can avoid the dangers of obviousness to some extent by starting with a rather unusual instance of tacit thinking, even though I could as well choose any number of everyday experiences. A few years ago, a distinguished psychiatrist demonstrated to his students a patient who was having a mild fit of some kind. Later, the class discussed the question whether this has been an epileptic or a hysteroepileptic seizure. The matter was finally settled by the psychiatrist. "Gentlemen," he said, "you have seen a true epileptic seizure. I cannot tell you how to recognize it, but you will learn this by more extensive experience." Clinical practitioners call the peculiar, indescribable appearance of an illness its facies, but we may call it simply its physiognomy, so as to relate it to the delicately varied expressions of the human face, which we can likewise identify without being able to tell quite how we recognize them. The peculiar appearance of a species of plants or animals by which experts can recognize a specimen of it at a glance is the same kind of thing. All practical classes in universities, from physics to medicine, are conducted for the purpose of transmitting a knowledge of things which we cannot be adequately define. People who know a physiognomy but cannot identify the particulars by which they know it obviously know more than they can tell. They know both the physiognomy and its parts, but in different ways. They know the physiognomy by attending to it, but its parts only by relying on them as clues to the physiognomy. The psychiatrist in my story looked at the patient and at his illness and could tell what it was, but he could not tell what the symptoms were on the awareness of which he relied for attending to the appearance of the illness. The image of the illness is, of course, composed of its characteristic particulars, and anyone who recognizes this image knows in this sense also its particulars, so that if he yet be unable to identify these, this shows that he does not know them in themselves. So these are things which he knows and cannot tell. All this is, as I have said, fairly obvious, but it is perhaps even more obvious in the case of practical skills. I can say that I know how to ride a bicycle or how to swim, but this does not mean that I can tell how I manage to keep my balance on a bicycle or keep afloat when swimming. I may not have the slightest idea of how I do this, or even an entirely wrong, a grossly imperfect idea of it, and yet go on cycling or swimming merrily. This fact can be analyzed on similar lines as those I have applied to physiognomies. I can say that I know how to cycle and swim by attending to these acts as a whole, while I know the elementary muscular acts which constitute my skill only by relying on these elements for the purpose of achieving the performances to which I am attending. Actually, skillful knowing and doing are rarely exercised in isolation. We usually meet with a blend of the two. Medical diagnostics combines them about equally. To percuss a lung is a muscular feat combined with a delicate discrimination of the sounds thus elicited. We do, in fact, speak equally of grasping a difficult subject matter or a difficult skill. And there is something in common between these two cases, which will lead on to another essential feature of our knowing of things to which we cannot attend in themselves, and which we hence know but cannot tell. I have said that we rely on our awareness of these things for attending to something else. This shows that an action is involved on our part. This relying is an action for the purpose of which this achievement is undertaken. It is an action for the purpose of which we rely on these things, which we then know, and know only in terms of the results achieved by relying on our awareness of them and not in themselves. The act of relying, as I have suggested, will become clearer by my next example, which is of great interest also in itself. It is the case of visual perception. It is known that the seeing of an object is a result of certain things we do inside our eyes. And this has been a major subject of philosophy for centuries. Let me show what part is played here by things we know and cannot tell. When we look at an object, we see it standing against a background as situated at a certain place, defined by its distance and its orientation in space. We see it in motion or at rest. It is seen also as having a certain size and a particular color and a certain shape. It is seen not only in contours, but also in depth. We see an object in this definite way owing to the adjustment of our pupils, our lenses, and of the convergence of our eyes, which jointly fashion two retinal images in our eyes on which the perceived picture is based. But perception is co-determined also by the messages received from the internal ear, from the muscles of the eye by which we adjust our eyes, and indeed by all the muscles which keep our body and head in position. And, what is very important, an important contribution is made also by memory traces. We tend to see what we expect to see. These internal data both guide the reflexes of our eyes in adjusting our retinal images and also control our evaluation of these images and the other internal stimuli in terms of our perception, in terms of how we see the object. Nor is this all that is involved in seeing a thing as we do. Gestalt psychology has been most successful in tracing the far-reaching effect exercised by peripheric parts of the visual field in determining what we see at the center. As seen in isolation, a jumping cat may appear to change its color from off-white to dark gray. But when a window is included in the field of vision, we see the cat unchangingly as of the same white or gray. What happens here is that when we notice from the corner of our eye a beam of sunshine coming through a window, the eye automatically allows for the variable illumination of the cat as it jumps about and sees it always having the same color. All the things that go on inside our eyes and other parts of our body in the process of seeing an object and the memories which enter into our seeing from the back of our minds and the details noticed from the corner of our eyes are things on the awareness of which we rely for seeing an object in a particular way. In this sense, we undoubtedly know these things, but we have little or no knowledge of them in themselves. Our control of these subsidiary elements of perception and our integration of them in the way we see the perceived object may go on almost automatically, but there's always a measure of deliberate attention involved, the kind of action which I've been talking about before, by which we rely on the particulars for seeing something which they comprehend. There is clear evidence that the skill of seeing things is acquired by a process of learning. Chimpanzees reared in the dark need several weeks' practice before they recognize a nursing bottle, which they have been using all the time. But before going any further in analyzing these tacit constituents of knowledge, let me try to reassure you that we are in fact moving towards the anxious issues raised by my analysis of our age in the first lecture. I have illustrated there in a number of ways how science, which has been the great liberating force of the Enlightenment, has released the immense intellectual, moral, and social progress achieved since the French Revolution, how this rise of science has also become an ample source of popular fallacies. And I have traced back these fallacies to a false ideal of science, which, though highly fruitful up to a point, leads astray beyond this. I formulated this false ideal in the Laplacian conception of universal knowledge, as represented by a complete topography of all elementary particles and the forces acting between them. I admitted that Laplace was right in saying that from such information one could predict the atomic topography of the world for any future moment of time, but I said that he overlooked the fact that such a topography would by itself tell us nothing of interest and indeed would represent nothing that we could actually experience. But how? How could Laplace overlook this? How could it be generally overlooked up to this day? The answer is that the gap between an atomic topography of the world and our actual experience of the world was covered up by a tremendous tacit assumption, an assumption which embodies once more the ideals of science. It consists in the belief, the passionate belief, that all experience can ultimately be represented in the mathematically determined relation of the ultimate particles underlying experience. By this assumption, scientific rationalism excludes, in principle, all tacit knowing. Science might admit, of course, that we know a great deal that we cannot tell, but it would insist that all such knowledge can ultimately be made explicit. That's what I mean by saying that this is an ideal. So you see that what I have already said about the realm of unspoken knowledge does collide head-on with the ideal of scientific rationalism. And you may indeed anticipate that, once firmly established, the admission of such tacit knowledge may force a revision of the ideal of science at the very point where it tends to produce its baleful consequences. But this is but a first skirmish in a battle to which we shall presently return in force, armed with sharper weapons. Let me go on to elaborate for this purpose on the structure and function of tacit knowledge. There is an obvious difference between identifying a disease by relying on our tacit awareness of its symptoms and the act of perceiving an object outside by relying on our tacit awareness of adjustments inside our eyes and so on, all these clues hidden inside our body. The difference is that the image of the illness coincides in space with the position of the clues, which serves us to recognize it.
But this is not true when we look at an object in front of us. We are aware of the clues of perception, of seeing something, in terms of the appearance of an object situated at some distance from the clues, most of which are inside our body. Since this distinction applies to a wide range of unspoken knowledge, I shall try to express it by two different labels. And this will bring in a very important conception, namely the conception of meaning. It is reasonable to say that when we recognize a physiognomy, say, the expression of a person's face or the nature of a disease, we are reading the meaning of its particulars, particulars to which we are not attending in themselves. And that, since the physiognomy is located in the same place as the particulars which constitute it, the physiognomy may be said to be the internal meaning of the particulars. On the other hand, the way we see an object may be said to represent the meaning of various clues on which we rely for seeing it in a particular way, and that hence the meaning of these clues is situated away from them, external to them. It is a meaning that is external to them. I believe that this analysis largely disposes of the question which has occupied philosophers so much as to the grounds on which we make sense of clues inside our body in terms of the way we see an object at some distance in front of us. For this is now but a particular instance of the fundamental fact that we are able to make sense, to lend a meaning to clues or particulars to which we are not attending at the moment, by relying on them for attending to something else, so that the appearance of that to which we are attending may be said to be the meaning of these clues or particulars. Once we have fully realized this way of making sense, the question of where the meaningful thing will be situated in space becomes a subordinate question, the more so since the externality of meaning, which is so puzzling in the case of perception, can be shown to be merely a matter of degree. Think of the use of tools. In hammering in a nail, we attend to the hammer as it hits the nail. But we do so, of course, by being aware of the way the handle of the hammer impinges on our palm. The rower is aware of the strain in his hands and arms only in terms of the blades tearing the water. The blind man groping his way by means of a stick is aware of its impact on his palm in terms of the way the outer end of the stick hits an object in front of him. And so on. When using a probe, the surgeon feels the point at which its tip touches the walls of a cavity he's exploring. In all these cases, the thing to which we are attending is situated at some distance of the things on the awareness of which we rely for attending to them. In other words, the meaning of these clues is situated at some distance away from the clues. But this distance can be reduced at will to a vanishing point, and so we can achieve a continuous linkage between internal and external kinds of meaning which reveals their essential kinship. And we may notice then, next, the peculiar fact that insofar as the meaning of clues lies apart from them, somewhere else than the clues themselves, it always tends to be shifted outside, that is, away from ourselves. Once we realize this, it leads us to another remarkable fact. It makes us realize that there is one single thing in the world which we never look upon as on an object. This unique thing is our own body. To feel alive is to be aware of things going on in our own body, but not by attending to them. It is to rely on our awareness of these things in our body for attending to things outside. Our body is indeed the citadel of all tacit knowledge. Every time we make sense of the world, we rely on a tacit knowledge of the impacts that the world makes on our body. Visual perception is, of course, a particular striking feat of this kind. But I would include also the way we use a tool or a probe. I would agree with Samuel Butler that this is to use them as an extension of our body, that we assimilate these things to our body in using them. And this gives us the key to the conception of indwelling, which is of supreme importance for any adequate theory of knowledge. Since the way we rely on certain things subsidiarily for attending to something else is similar to our awareness of our body for making sense of the world outside, we may feel justified in saying that whenever we rely on our awareness of clues or particulars, of tools or probes, we are attending to something else, we are dwelling in these particulars or tools or probes as we dwell in our own body. Thus we shall comprise within one single framework of making sense the classical cases of external meaning, as when words mean certain objects, and of internal meaning as of music or pure mathematics. And this will prove a powerful tool for the vindication of reality. But now that I have mentioned in passing words, I cannot go on remolding the conception of meaning any further without first bringing out more fully the case of words like Peter and Paul, or tables and dogs, which mean definite, tangible objects. Proper names do this, of course, in a way quite similar to the way we use a probe. A man's name, by itself a meaningless sound, will make sense by being consistently used to point at the person whom it designates, exactly as the knocking of objects by a stick gradually acquires a sensible meaning. But the case of general terms, as when we speak of tables and dogs in general, is more interesting, for it too can be brought into our scheme of knowing, and in doing so, we shall dispose of a puzzle that philosophers have not ceased worrying about ever since Abelard brought it to their attention 900 years ago. Abelard pointed out that when we speak of the dog, we are not pointing at any definite object, as we do when we call a man by his name. The word dog is therefore merely a sound uttered with reference to an undefinable range of individual dogs, each of which is different from any single particular. 700 years later, Kant still declared himself unable to resolve the mystery of the way our intelligence forms and applies a general conception like that of dogs. This process, he writes in the Critique of Pure Reason, and I quote, is a skill so deeply hidden in the human soul that we may never guess the secret trick that nature employs here. I do not claim that I can resolve this mystery, but I think I can dispose of it, and that's what I said, I will dispose of it, by showing that it is but an instance among many others of the way we make sense of experience by an act of knowing clues to which we are not attending. Things at the back of our minds were included among the many clues of which we make sense in seeing an object in a particular way. We can say accordingly that the word dog denotes the joint meaning of a great many memories of dogs at the back of our minds. And this is what is meant by saying that the word dog denotes the concept of dogs. Once we clearly recognize that all knowing consists in attending to the joint meaning of a vast number of clues and particulars to which we are not attending for the time being, and many of which we may never be able to identify at all, we can no longer wonder about the way universal terms are used or applied. Once we see that all knowing has this structure, we shall accept this fact as the cornerstone of our concept of knowledge and cease to regard any particular instance of it as a puzzling anomaly as it appeared to Kant. This may be the point for driving home a curious element in my revised conception of knowledge. According to my analysis, meaning is established always by relying on our awareness of one thing for attending to another. The thing to which we are attending is then the meaning of the subsidiaries to which we are not attending at the time. It follows that if we can identify any such subsidiary and switch our attention to it, it should become meaningless. This conclusion is notoriously borne out for the case of words. Repeat the word table, table, table 20 times over, attending carefully to the sound, the movement of your lips and tongue in uttering the word, and its meaning will become remote and finally dissolve altogether. This is often expressed by saying that words used meaningfully are transparent, and that when we concentrate on any particular word as a sound, it becomes opaque. The transparent word is like a telescope through which we see its meaning. While, when rendered opaque, the word ceases to show us things beyond itself and blocks our sight by its own meaningless body. This is not to deny the possibility of defining a comprehensive entity more precisely by seeking to identify its particulars. Such an analysis deepens our understanding if it is followed by a reintegration of the particulars. Medical science tries to identify the several symptoms of diseases, and students will learn the list of such symptoms. But such a list will benefit them only if they learn to apply it practically at the bedside. The same is true of motion studies for the improvement of skills. A pianist will find himself paralyzed if he attends to the motion of his fingers instead of the music he is performing. But finger exercises will improve his performance when he once more subordinates his fingers to the music. This, by the way, is the difference between a pedantic analysis of a great text which destroys its meaning and an analysis which deepens our understanding of it. The humanities studied in universities fall under this judgment. We may add that the great movement of modern art, of which I spoke last week, has shown in its own way that the destruction of meaning can be the path to discovery. Impressionism was an atomization of the visual field, disregarding the way objects are usually seen and understood, and reintegrating them in a novel way. Soon after, Rimbaud discovered that a torrent of words bereft of their usual meaning can form great poetry. James Joyce performed a similar feat for the novel. And the movement reached its climax about 20 years ago when Sartre, in his masterpiece La Nausée, ushered us into the presence of total nothingness. This novel shows how one can reduce the universe to absurdity by attending to all its particulars in themselves. Then the pebble in your hand, the saliva in your mouth, and the words in your ear all become external, impersonal, monstrous items. I said last time that this method of discovery can hardly be pursued indefinitely, but this is not my point just now. I have brought up here Sartre's method of emptying the world of meaning for a different reason, namely because it beautifully illustrates the absurdity of the ideal of science to which it actually owed its inspiration. I have said that the ideal of science is represented up to this day by Laplace's conception of universal knowledge, and have rejected this on the grounds that a complete knowledge of all the particulars of the universe would tell us nothing that we are interested in, nothing that would answer any questions raised by experience. I have given as an example the question whether primroses planted last November will blossom next March, and said that this is not answered by telling us what the positions of all the atoms of the universe will be next March. But I have left open the question whether it is conceivable that ultimately our question may be answered, our question about the primroses or about anything else, by an atomic theory of primroses or something else of that kind, which we have experience of. Scientists as a body would unhesitatingly affirm that this is not only conceivable, but undeniable. But I think that you can already see the grounds on which I must deny it. If all meaningful experience can be known to us only by relying on our awareness of some things to which we are not attending and which we may never know, then an operation which strictly eliminates this tacit knowing must completely destroy all meaning. And this is precisely what a mathematical theory of the universe would be intended to do. For, to be completely explicit, all the data of a mathematical theory, as well as all the computations based on these data, must be presented to us at one single level of awareness. They could all be written on one immense blackboard, and we could attend equally to everything written on that blackboard. But this conception of a strictly explicit theory of the universe is logically untenable. We have seen that words mean something only by being transparent, by pointing to something beyond themselves. And this is true also of mathematical symbols. A theory of experience can never be wholly explicit, for it can never include its own bearing on experience. Its reference to experience must be the act of someone using the theory and applying it to something known already before and not hitherto explained by the theory. Hence, in order to mean something, the theory must be incomplete. It cannot mean anything in itself. If this argument appears too subtle, I can promise to make it blunter and more telling in my next lecture, by which time I shall have heavier artillery at my disposal. Meanwhile, let me complete this survey of the unspoken powers of the mind by revealing its highest form, the supreme achievements of which will spread a new and convincing light on what I have said so far of these powers when acting on a lower, more humdrum level. Let me return for a moment to the psychiatrist who, by virtue of his expert knowledge, diagnoses a true epileptic fit. "I cannot tell you how to recognize it," he said. "You will learn this by more extensive experience." This shows that in identifying the present case of the disease, the psychiatrist not only relied on his awareness of a whole range of cases which, in spite of their individual differences, he had identified in the past, but he is confident of his power to identify an unlimited number of future cases which might differ from those known before in an infinite variety of unpredictable ways. So the psychiatrist is talking here about things that have not yet happened, and what is more, he is speaking confidently of the meaning that these events will have, though he would admit that the particulars which will have this meaning may never be clearly known to him and may be altogether unidentifiable. This is, of course, but an instance of the applicability of a general term like table or dog to experience both past and future. Each of the nouns, verbs, adjectives, and adverbs of our language is deemed applicable to a vast range of instances yet unborn. Each of the few thousand commonly used English words, perhaps in this university a few 10,000, recurs on the average 100 million times, I have counted, in the daily conversation of people in England and America. As people continue to speak their language, they are assuming that the world is made up of a few thousand identifiable, meaningful features each of which will recur in their joint experience many million times a day. Thus, to use a vocabulary is to claim a detailed foreknowledge of all things to come and a capacity to identify them in terms of this foreknowledge. But this is only to serve as a prelude to a confrontation with the kind of dramatic foreknowledge which we meet in scientific discovery and technical invention. It is a commonplace that all research must start from a problem. Research can be successful only if the problem is good. It can be original only if the problem is original. But how can one see a problem, any problem, let alone a good and original problem? For to see a problem is to see something that is hidden. It is to have an intimation of the coherence of hitherto not comprehended particulars. The problem is good if this intimation is true. It is original if no one else can see the possibilities of comprehension that we are anticipating. To see a problem that will lead to a great discovery is not only to see something hidden, but to see something of which the rest of humanity cannot have even an inkling. All this is a commonplace. We take it for granted without noticing the clash of self-contradiction entailed in it. Yet Plato has pointed out this contradiction already in his dialogue entitled Meno. He says that the search for the solution of a problem is an absurdity. For either you know what you are looking for, then there is no problem. Or you do not know what you are looking for, then you are not looking for anything and cannot expect to find anything. The solution which Plato offered for this paradox was that all discovery is a remembering of past lives. This explanation has hardly ever been accepted, but neither has any other solution been offered which would avoid the contradiction. So we are faced with the fact that for 2,000 years and more, humanity has progressed by the efforts of people solving difficult problems, while all the time it could be shown that to do this was either meaningless or impossible. We have here the classical case of Poe's purloined letter, of the momentous document lying casually in front of everybody and hence overlooked by all. For Meno shows conclusively that if all knowledge is explicit, that is, capable of being clearly stated, then we cannot know a problem or look for its solution. And Meno shows therefore also that if problems nevertheless exist and discoveries can be made by solving them, this proves that we can know and know important things that we cannot tell. I have said that in the case of the most important problems which lead to great discoveries, this knowledge is accessible only to a single individual. It is a distinctly personal knowledge. This personal character of a problem is shown already in the fact that nothing is a problem unless it puzzles somebody. Take the famous paradox of the liar. That is the fact that if I say of myself that I am lying, the statement is true only if it is false. This paradox, known for about 2,000 years, was no problem during that time, for it was shrugged aside as a mere sophism. It became a fundamental problem of logic when modern logicians began to be puzzled by it. And no problem will ever be solved unless he who sees it is not only puzzled but obsessed by it. Asked by his pupils in jest what they should do to become a Pavlov, the master answered in all seriousness, "Get up in the morning with your problem before you. Breakfast with it. Go to the laboratory with it. Eat your lunch with it. Keep it before you after dinner. Go to bed with it in your mind. Dream about it." But what? What is the object of this intense preoccupation? How can we concentrate our attention on something we don't know? Yet this is precisely what we are told to do. and particularly clearly said, told to do by Polya, the classic writer on problem solving in mathematics. I quote him. "Look at the unknown," he says. "Look at the end. Remember your aim. Do not lose sight of what is required. Keep in mind what you are working for." And then, with the emphasis of his italics, "Look at the unknown. Look at the conclusion." Well, no advice could be more emphatic, nor appear more absurd, unless interpreted in the terms of tacit knowing. For to look at the unknown means then, as interpreted in terms of tacit knowing, that we should look at the known data as clues to the unknown, as pointers to it, as parts of it. It is this passionate striving to comprehend the known data by looking at the unknown that eventually discloses the unknown in a blaze of discovery. This is indeed unspoken thought writ large, writ as large as the range of scientific genius. Current theories of the scientific method, which inevitably represent it as an explicit process of inference, must ignore the part played by scientific genius. They give a meticulous production of Hamlet without the prince. But our study of unspoken thought shall reveal yet another matter of major significance. We are told that great scientific discoveries are marked by their fruitfulness, and this is true. But when we are told to recognize truth by its fruitfulness, it sounds like being told to recognize the snark by its habit of dining the following day. Can we recognize that a statement is true by appreciating the wealth of its yet undiscovered consequences? This would, of course, be nonsensical if we had to know explicitly what is yet undiscovered. But it does make sense if we admit that we can have a tacit foreknowledge of yet undiscovered things. This is indeed what the Copernicans must have had, this tacit foreknowledge of undiscovered things, when they passionately maintained during 140 years before Newton proved the point that the heliocentric system was not merely a convenient way of computing the paths of planets, as the Aristotelians pressed them to admit, but it was really true, but that it was really true. It appears that our capacity to know that a statement is true is to know more than we can tell. That a true discovery which solves the scientist's problem is itself fraught with further intimations of an indeterminate range, and that we accept this discovery as true by committing ourselves to a belief in all these yet undisclosed, indeed yet unthinkable consequences. Since, according to this, we can have no explicit knowledge of these unknown things, there can also be no explicit justification of a scientific truth. That as we can know a problem and feel sure that it is pointing to something hidden behind it, we can be aware also of the yet hidden implications of a scientific discovery and feel sure that they will prove right. We can feel sure of this because in contemplating the discovery, we are looking at it not in itself, but more significantly, as a clue to a reality of which it is a manifestation. The pursuit of discovery is conducted from its very start in these terms. All the time we are guided by sensing the presence of a hidden reality towards which our clues are pointing. And the discovery which terminates and satisfies this pursuit is still sustained by the same vision. It claims to have made contact with reality, a reality which, being real, may yet reveal itself to future eyes in an indefinite range of unexpected manifestations. Here we catch our first glimpse of the promised land, of the vindication of reality. I hope that the journey that brought us here has not appeared to you altogether as 40 years of wandering through the desert. At any rate, I think I can claim to have followed up my introduction, suggesting that the destruction of reality imposed by a false ideal of science cannot be remedied except by uprooting some basic conceptions taken for granted by the modern mind ever since the rise of scientific rationalism about 300 years ago. Several centuries have passed since Descartes asserted in his Discourse on Method that the mark of truth was that it gave us clear and distinct ideas. And up to our own days, this Cartesian doctrine has still been emphatically echoed by Wittgenstein in his Tractatus, when commanding that what cannot be said clearly, of that we should remain silent. And now I am telling you that all that we know, is the meaning of things to which we cannot attend at the time, and the subsequent identification of which is necessarily uncertain and often impossible. And I have gone further by asserting that the very concept of a wholly explicit statement is absurd. It can have no bearing on experience except by the tacit act of someone seeing experience in its terms, an experience which must have been tacitly acquired beforehand. Well, all this takes us pretty far, as I have said it would. But I hope that you may yet go along with it if you agree that, as I have shown in my last lecture, something has gone profoundly wrong in the development of scientific rationalism, the earliest stages of which have brought such great blessings to humanity.